Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals, beginning our fiscal year 2011 and starting our fall cases this morning. We appreciate you all being here. We have only one case on our 9 o'clock docket, which we will hear. Then we'll take a break until the 10:30 docket, at which time we will hear that one case that we have for oral argument then. I call Alford versus State of Texas. Mr. Davidson.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm prepared to answer whatever questions the court wants to go into and go in whichever direction the court wants to go, but if the court doesn't object, I'll start with the distinction between the subjective, what I call the subjective test and the objective test, and why I believe the objective test ought to apply in this case. The subjective test focuses on the intent of the officer. Did the officer have pure motives in asking the question he asked? Whereas the objective test uses more of a reasonable officer standard of what should a reasonable officer have known, and specifically, should a reasonable officer have known that the question he asked was reasonably likely to elicit incriminating information? The subjective test really comes from footnote 14 of the Pennsylvania versus Muniz case. And I think it's significant that footnote 14 is not supported by a majority of the justices. It's in a section of the opinion that was supported only by a plurality of four justices. It is also a quote from an amicus brief by the United States. So it's not even necessarily endorsed by the court, or even by the plurality. It's simply part of an amicus brief. And the way I read that footnote, which is a quote from the amicus brief, it was intended to be an example of a category of booking questions that would still require Miranda warnings. In effect, the amicus, the United States, was saying, booking questions as a whole are not subject to Miranda, but we recognize that there are a few that still will be. And that was, footnote 14 was kind of an example of a category that still would be subject to Miranda. I don't know that it was ever intended to be an exclusive category. So to rest the subjective test upon that footnote 14, I think is pretty flimsy support, both because it wasn't supported by a majority of the justices, and it was a quote from an amicus brief. The objective test, what would a reasonable officer who, with his knowledge, expect the question to elicit? Would he expect the question to elicit incriminating information? That, I think, is a much more reasonable standard. It comes from the Innis case, Rhode Island versus Innis. It is, in fact, a holding of the court. Now, it specifically is in the context of what is custodial interrogation. But I think it's a very reasonable standard, and in fact, it's been adopted, as I say in my briefs, it's been adopted as the test in a number of courts. Two of the federal courts of appeals have explicitly adopted the objective test, in effect, that test. And I think that is an appropriate test, because in this country, we're always suspicious of the police. And I want to phrase that right, we don't entirely trust the government, and the police are part of the government. I pulled out two quotes from prior Supreme Court cases that I think illustrate this attitude. One is from Justice Brandeis's dissent in the Olmstead versus United States case at 277 U.S. 438, a 1928 case, where he says, "Men born to freedom are naturally alert to repel invasion of their liberty by evil-minded rulers. The greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning but without understanding." The objective test is kind of a check on that zeal. Also, in a much more recent case, Davis versus Washington, a 2006 Supreme Court case at 547 U.S. 813, the court stated, We may not, however, vitiate constitutional guarantees when they have the effect of allowing the guilty to go free. In effect, what the court was stating there was, we can't invoke constitutional rights when they don't harm the prosecution and then ignore them when they do. And I think that is important to keep in mind in a case like this.
What do you say, Mr. Davidson, to the state's argument that even if it was erroneous to admit this evidence, that the error was harmless?
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, the drugs were found on top of the flash drive. And, of course, it's the ownership of the flash drive that the officer asked about. He held up the flash drive and he said, is this yours? And the admission of Mr. Alford that that was his flash drive was, in effect, admitting that the drugs were his, too, because there was no other way that the flash drive could have gotten under the drugs unless the drugs were his.
I recall that he did not testify.
He did not testify, yes, sir.
Therefore, there was no evidence before the jury other than the policeman's testimony that the back seat was void of anything before he put him in the car. So there was no evidence that it was not his, that drugs were not his, correct? They were presented with the evidence from the policeman that the back seat was clean. Afterwards, he discovered the flash drive and the drugs, and that's the only evidence before the jury as to who the drugs belong to.
That is true, and that
okay.
is...
So there's no, well, we can believe the officer or we can believe the person that was arrested.
Well,
so
keep
how in... what you're saying is if this hadn't been there, the jury would have disbelieved the officer. Because that's the only evidence that they have.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
First of all, keep in mind, the state has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. There's always the issue of reasonable doubt to argue. Yes, the officer's testimony was that he searched the back seat. The problem is...
And he's making furtive movements in the back seat while he sees it. Yes, okay.
True.
Yes.
True. That's pretty ambiguous as to exactly what was going on. I believe there was testimony by the officer or by somebody that the defendant said that his side hurt and he was moving around because his side hurt. And given the fact that he'd been running from the police and that he'd been taken down and arrested, I mean, that's entirely possible. But what the judge's ruling did was it deprived the defense of the argument that the officer was not necessarily lying, but that he just did not do a thorough inspection of his vehicle, that he didn't, maybe the drugs were in there somewhere and he just missed them. Maybe he didn't do a thorough thorough inspection. He could have been in a hurry, whatever. Now, the defense didn't go into that. I recognize that. They didn't go into an elaborate cross-examination like that. But that area of cross-examination was pretty much foreclosed by the judge's ruling because, as I mentioned in my briefs, that was no longer a credible possibility once you find the flash drive under the drugs. Because
there's nothing in the record as to what the police officer would have said in response to the cross-examination to give some legs to your argument that it was harmful error. See, the officer said, well, I think I did a good job of examining, but I'm not really sure. I'm just telling you what I routinely do. I don't specifically remember this particular date that I examined the back seat. There's nothing in the record to support where you're going here. Well, tell me
but
if
I,
you're wrong.
But,
I mean,
well, but I think the reason there's nothing in the record is because of the judge's ruling that foreclosed that area.
Well, you didn't think it would do any good.
I didn't actually represent him in the trial, but
I
understand what you're saying.
You got to make a bill, you got to make a record. If down the road you turned out well, the trial counsel turned out to be correct in his argument about the admissibility of the flash drive.
I'm not sure I understand that last comment, Your Honor.
Well, if down the road here today we decide that trial counsel was right in his argument about the flash drive, didn't he have an obligation to go ahead with this argument in the event that we turn this around, to give some legs to your argument about harmful error?
Well, I don't. If we're talking about making that argument to the jury, I don't think that's
soliciting the testimony from the officer, going ahead with the cross-examination of the officer.
Well, it would have been nice if he'd done that in the way of a offer of proof outside the hearing of the jury. I don't know that you want to do that in front of the jury as a matter of trial tactics, because, you know, you're trying to impress the jury and you don't want to lose credibility with the jury by going off on a rabbit trail that is obviously a waste of everybody's time in view of the judge's ruling, which the jury doesn't know anything about. So as a matter of trial strategy, I don't think he would have done it in front of the jury. Now, do I wish he had gone on, you know, made an offer of proof outside the presence of the jury? Would have been nice. It may have been helpful. But I think he understood that going in front of the jury with that wasn't going to fly anymore. If we apply the objective test, which I believe is the proper test, then I would compare this to the situation where the police find a purse with drugs in it. And they hold up the purse and say, "Is this yours?" And the defendant says, "Yes," without Miranda warnings, of course. And if they do that, they have violated Miranda. I can't imagine that would not be a violation of Miranda, to hold up a purse with drugs in it, because it is so clearly incriminating. There's not much difference here.
Except that the purse and the drugs would be offered into evidence.
Well, we're talking about, yeah, but I don't see that as being a significant difference. It would still be an incriminating statement, and I think it would still be inadmissible, because any reasonable officer would know, if you hold up a purse that has drugs in it and say, "Is this purse yours?" That's going to be terribly incriminating.
Are there other items that were inventoried, or is this the singular item?
You know, I don't know that the record actually reflects that. I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't remember reading that in a record. But I would like to point out that if we analyze this based on what a reasonable officer would have expected, we have to keep in mind that Officer Ramirez, who was the one that asked the question, "Is this yours?" was also involved in the search of the vehicle that found the flash drive. This might be a very different case if, say, a jail officer who knew nothing about the drugs had been given the flash drive and had asked, "Mr. Alford, is this your flash drive?" I say that because context is important in this case. In any case, it's what an officer with the knowledge that Officer Ramirez had would have reasonably expected regarding that question. Would he have reasonably expected that question to elicit incriminating information? And in this, under these particular facts, Officer Ramirez knew that the drugs had been found on top of the flash drive, and therefore he knew how incriminating that flash drive potentially could be, or at least he should have known. I won't say he knew, because the trial court found that he put it in property and apparently didn't think anything about it. But any reasonable officer would have known that flash drive found directly under the drugs, not just nearby, not just in the vicinity, right under the drugs, was terribly incriminating. And that's the distinction I draw between the state's brief, where they talk about innocuous items of property being exempt from, you know, being under the booking questions exception, and I can accept that. But this was not an innocuous item of property. This was a piece of property that went directly to the heart of the case against Mr. Alford, because proof that the flash drive was his also proved the drugs were his, in effect. And that was the only evidence that they had that the flash drive was his own admission. If you throw out that admission, if that is excluded under Miranda, the state had no evidence that flash drive belonged to Mr. Alford, and therefore it could have been anybody's flash drive.
Of course, it's really not the flash drive. flash drive, it's the location of the flash drive. So the ownership of the flash drive is maybe marginal. It depends on where it was found.
You are correct, Your Honor, in saying that the location of the flash drive was critical because it was right under the drugs, in such a location that there was no other explanation than it must have been discarded with the drugs. And that's why I say, when Mr. Alford admitted that the flash drive was his, he was in effect admitting the drugs were his. And obviously that's terribly incriminating. This case is far from an overwhelming evidence case. You know, you've got circumstantial evidence that the officer, if you throw out the flash drive, if you throw out Mr. Alford's admission that the flash drive was his, then what you've got left is an officer who says, well, I searched the car at the start of my day, and that afternoon I arrested somebody, and after I got him out of the car, I found the drugs there. Well, you know.
After he's acting suspiciously in the back seat and then
searched. Correct.
All right, Mr. Davidson, your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see the lights. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Curl.
May it please the court, my name is David Curl, and I'm here representing the state. I intend to concentrate on the harm argument, and if I have time, I'll touch on the merits. Since this is a constitutional issue, the question is whether or not we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the complaint of evidence, appellant's ownership of the flash drive, didn't move the jury from a state of non-persuasion to a state of persuasion. I want to go through appellant's evolving harm arguments. In his original brief, appellant argued it was harmful because the flash drive evidence relieved the jury from having to believe Officer Ramirez's testimony alone. And we showed in our brief that that's just not a valid, not a credible argument because, first, the state's evidence was overwhelming. Officer Ramirez's testimony, if believed, left absolutely no doubt that appellant was the source of those drugs. Also, the flash drive testimony was neither compelling, it wasn't compelling, and also it relied upon Officer Ramirez's credibility. You know, if the jury is going to believe Officer Ramirez about where he found the flash drive and what appellant said about the flash drive, they're going to believe that Officer Ramirez about he searched the car. And if they believe he searched the car, then appellant was going to be convicted. In his reply brief, appellant changes his harm argument, as I understand it. He first argues that the flash drive is some kind of super-duper strong evidence on page 12 of his reply brief. And I point out, first of all, that that contrasts with his objection in front of the jury, which was that this evidence wasn't even relevant. That's at page 74 of volume 4. But his contention that it's strong evidence is just not right. I mean, again, if this argument first begins with a requirement that the jury believe Officer Ramirez on this point, and as the rest of his harm argument relies upon the jury disbelieving Officer Ramirez's harm argument. Moreover, even if the jury believed Officer Ramirez about where he found the flash drive and what appellant said about it, they could have easily determined that that was little or no proof that appellant was the source of the drugs. I mean, it's speculation to decide that that proves that he owned the drugs. I mean, the flash drive could have been kicked under the drugs inadvertently. I mean, it's just not very compelling evidence. A second appellant argues harm because he says that the admission of his ownership of the flash drive made it impossible for him to go after Officer Ramirez with regard to his testimony that he searched the car. Well, first of all, that's self-serving speculation, and it doesn't really have any relevance to our harm test. I mean, he's arguing harm on the basis of some other trial, not on the trial that we had. But more importantly, it's self-serving speculation, which is contradicted by the record. First, appellant did go after Officer Ramirez at pages 107 through 109 of Volume 4. He just didn't get anywhere with it because there was nowhere to get. And secondly, he argued to the jury, pretty much his sole argument to the jury on the issue of guilt was that he wasn't the source of these drugs, so he had every motivation in the world to go after Officer Ramirez's claim that he searched the car. In fact, he argued to the jury at page 175 of Volume 4 that the officer was merely assuming that appellant was the source of these drugs. The state, we did discuss the flash drive at in our jury argument for about six sentences at page 185 and 186. But that was after appellant had brought up the flash drive. Appellant actually argued that the flash drive was exculpatory. His argument was that the officer had been so sloppy in giving the flash drive back to appellant when any competent police officer would have assumed that there was evidence appellant was a drug dealer on that flash drive, that it shows that you can't trust Officer Ramirez when he said he searched the car. So, you know, that ought to cut against a harm argument. I mean, cut against appellant's claim of harm if he actually argued to the jury that it was helpful to him. Another point about the issue of harm that I really want to emphasize is that appellant in his reply brief at page 15 says that his flight from the police officer was almost irrelevant. Well, first of all, the Court of Criminal Appeals has repeatedly held that evidence of flight can be very strong evidence of guilt. In Clayton versus State, I'll supply a letter with these sites, but there's a 2007 opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals in Clayton versus State where the Court of Criminal Appeals stated, quote, a rational jury considering Clayton's explanation could draw a strong inference of guilt based upon his flight from the park. Mr. Clayton had claimed he was a good Samaritan and then he fled. Well, we believe that our case is kind of similar to that. In Williams versus State, the Court of Criminal Appeals from 1980 said that flight from officers, while not sufficient evidence of guilt when standing alone, when accompanied by other evidence, as in this case, is a strong circumstance of guilt. Well, in our case, Officer Ramirez saw appellant with a beer in an area where it was illegal to have a beer, and he went up and talked to him. He asked Mr. Ramirez, do you have narcotics on you? And Mr. Ramirez's response was not to deny it. It was to start backing away. At that point, Officer Ramirez said, don't go anywhere. Or he said, you're detained. And appellant took off running. Well, that it's hard to imagine a stronger inference of guilt that can be associated with flight than when you take off running when a police officer asks you if you have drugs, and then you drugs are found in an area which only you could have left them. And again, at volume 4, page 61, when the officer asked him if he had narcotics, appellant didn't deny it. So a couple more points. On page 14 of his reply brief, appellant dismisses our cites to Hennessy, Costello, and Simpson as involving overwhelming evidence. He says that they're not appropriate or not apt because those cases there was overwhelming evidence. Well, our contention is that the evidence was at least as strong in our case as it was in any of those. So for those reasons, we believe that the court should find that the evidence was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I just briefly want to touch on the merits issue. Let me begin by acknowledging that I find the booking exception extremely confusing, and the cases from across the country seem to be all over the place. As I understand it, there seem to be about four approaches. First is an idea that if it's a normal booking question, then it's okay. You don't have to look at the facts of the case. If it looks like an administrative question, it's okay. And I believe that's what the approach the Court of Criminal Appeals has taken. That's in Cross versus State, which we've cited, and in McCambridge versus State, which is from 1986. There isn't a hint in those cases that I can find that they say that some booking questions are not okay based on the facts of the case. They say, booking question, it's okay.
Well, but I could say, is this your purse, the one that has the drugs in it? It's our normal booking, of course, to find out if this is your purse, to put it in the safekeeping.
I think that would be okay under this approach. The problem is that if you start making this some complicated legal question, then there isn't really a point to the booking exception. The idea is that if you have these standard booking questions that you need for jail administration, then you shouldn't have to have a lawyer down there interrogating the person.
Well, I mean, it seems kind of obvious that it's okay to ask a booking question if you don't utilize what the person admits to be their own for any other purpose other than to identify it's theirs and it goes in the security area so they get it back.
Well,
here we're using it, you know, as part of the offense.
Well, I understand this is only litigated when it hurts the defendant. I understand that, but I don't see anything in either Cross or McCambridge that says that some booking questions are not okay based on the facts. And Rhode Island versus Ennis expressly exempts booking questions from the scope of interrogation. We cited United States versus Gaskin, a D.C. Circuit case, where they said, well, the police officers need to ask a person that they're searching his residence. Is this your residence? And we don't care whether that subsequently hurts the defendant or whether the officer should have known that. It's just an administrative question. We've also cited the Beaumont decision in Mapes.
Who first mentioned the flash drive in this trial?
I believe we introduced it, yes.
We
introduced his admission.
The first mention of the flash drive was by the prosecution.
That's my recollection.
And so the first involvement of the jury with the flash drive was for the prosecutor asking questions of the police officer who asked the question, is this your flash drive?
Yes, sir.
And at that point, then the question of what the officer was doing whenever he asked the question in the first place focuses back on what were the facts at that time as far as what the officer knew in terms of the booking exception.
What he knew?
Sure.
He knew the drugs.
In his mind that he found this flash drive under a bag of drugs.
Right. Yes, sir.
And isn't it? Without doubt, the next logic is that because this is your flash drive and the officers testified that he found it under the bag of drugs, that it related to the offense.
I think that that's a tenuous connection, but I'll concede there is a connection. It is some evidence that a jury might decide was evidence that he owned the drugs.
Well, wasn't that the follow-up question to, officer, what did you ask this man about this flash drive? Did you find a bag of drugs on top of the flash drive?
He testified he found the drugs on the flash drive. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And what other purpose would you introduce the flash drive for other than to connect the drugs to the defendant?
Yeah, I agree that that was our prosecutor's intention. I'm just, okay. My harm argument was that I don't think it's a very compelling connection. But on the merits issue, I don't think that under the under a pure application of Rhode Island versus Innis exception for booking questions, that it matters whether it was incriminating or whether the officer should have known it was incriminating. But assuming you don't accept that position, some courts apply, they look at the intent of the police officer. Was he trying to obtain incriminating evidence? And that's a question of fact for the trial court. And there isn't any evidence that the police officer was trying to get incriminating evidence. He said that he was trying to figure out what to do with his flash drive. And the fact that it was such an unnecessary question just a routine question. It was a thoughtless question. Ideally, he should have put it in the seized evidence and somebody should have looked at it. But he just decided that he needed to go through these standard questions and get rid of it. Cases applying this intent standard are in our brief at 16 and 17. I don't think even appellant would contend that he would win under that standard. Some courts look at what the defendant thought was happening, whether he thought he was being interrogated, and we've cited some cases on that in our brief at 20 and 23, it's United States versus Brown and Falk versus State. Again, there's no evidence that appellant regarded himself to be under interrogation. We believe that we would win under that standard. Now, the standard appellant wants, and frankly, many courts apply this standard, or at least some courts apply it, is a question that just asks whether the officer should have reasonably anticipated that he might get an incriminating response. Well, the biggest problem with this standard is that it just obliterates the booking exception. I mean, this is the standard for every question that a police officer asks a defendant when he's in custody. You might as well shred the booking exception because there isn't anything left of it if this is the test. Because
is this the gold watch that you had in your vest pocket? That has nothing to do, unless this is a robbery case, that has nothing to do with whether or not he had drugs in his pocket.
Right.
But
we don't need the booking exception for that. You would just win under it's not designed to obtain a incriminating statement. I mean, any time a police officer talks to a defendant in custody, you apply this standard of should he anticipated an incriminating response. And if that's all they're saying by the booking exception, then it's just a lot of confusion for no point, because we would have the standard appellant once, even if the Supreme Court had never said a word about the booking exception. And even under this standard, courts will look at the intent of the police. In Innocent, note 7, they say the intent of the police is relevant. If you're interested in this last kind of standard, we would urge the court to adopt the Eighth Circuit approach, where they have this approach, but they still leave something of the booking exception. In a case called United States versus Ochoa Gonzalez, which is from 2010, they say that the question is only improper if the government agent should reasonably be aware that the information sought, while merely basic information, for merely basic information purposes in the usual case, is directly relevant to the substantive offense charged. Ochoa Gonzalez, the person was indicted for identity theft. The officer asked him, or the agent asked her, what her name was, and they said, "Your name is not directly relevant to the charge of identity theft." And under that standard, the ownership of this flash drive was not directly relevant to appellant's charge of possessing drugs. So we would pray that the court affirm appellant's conviction. Is there any questions? I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curl. Mr. Davidson, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you clarify for me, your brief says that there was a hearing on the trial defense counsel's objections to the admissibility of this testimony, and the state said that there was only an objection as to relevancy. Can you clear that up? I haven't read the record yet.
My recollection of the record was that there was a hearing outside the presence of the jury, and a fairly extensive one, actually. And I believe the citation is in my brief. As far as the harm issue, the focus, as I understand the law, is not on whether the evidence would be sufficient without the erroneously admitted evidence. The focus is on the impact of the erroneously admitted evidence on the jury. And as I point out in my brief, in this case, not only did the jury hear about it as evidence, but the prosecutor then argued it in his closing on guilt-innocence, which, of course, was after the defense had sat down and couldn't argue anymore.
I'm just still concerned that there's no other evidence for the jury to consider.
Well, I would make this distinction, Your Honor. With that admission that the flash drive was Mr. Alford's, okay, with that erroneously admitted information, the jury had to then believe that Officer Ramirez lied. I don't think there was any other credible explanation for the testimony other than that he lied. If that does not come in and you don't have that evidence, the jury could have believed that he lied and acquitted on that basis, or they could have believed that he was just rushed, that he was incompetent, that he was not thorough, he wasn't careful. Any of those could have explained why he didn't find the drugs during his inspection. And that is where I believe the harm comes in. Now, as far as the, I wanted to talk about a case that was emphasized in the state's brief, the Court of Criminal Appeals case, the Carter case, which is a very, very recent case. And they used that Carter case to argue that the subjective test ought to apply and that the Court of Criminal Appeals would apply a subjective test. I'd like to point out to the court that, in fact, there were both pre-Miranda statements and post-Miranda statements in that case. What Carter addressed was the post-Miranda statements. The trial court had, in fact, excluded the defendant's pre-Miranda statements, the statements she gave before the Miranda warnings. And the issue in the Carter case was, okay, we've got these inadmissible statements before Miranda warnings, then we have Miranda warnings, and then the defendant makes more statements after being warned and waived his rights. And should those post-Miranda statements come in? And the court said, yes, they should, based on Oregon versus Elstat, that basically talked about, you know, an inadvertent, relatively minor Miranda violation and then Miranda rights, and you don't keep out the post-Miranda statements. So I think Carter is not at all supportive of what the state argues, and in fact, I think it supports the defense because the pre-Miranda statements in that case were suppressed. Finally, with regard to Ochoa, I'll just mention briefly, the question there was about the defendant's name. Well, a defendant's name is expressly one of the booking questions that the Supreme Court approved in the Muniz case. So I don't think that that's very strong evidence for the state. And in fact, in this case, in Mr. Alford's case, the question that was asked was directly relevant to the charged offense, and that was what the Eighth Circuit said was, you know, the booking question is okay unless it's directly relevant to the charged offense.
Why don't you tell us exactly what rule it is that you're propounding?
I believe the rule basically goes back to Rhode Island versus Innis, which is what an officer, under the circumstances, with the knowledge the officer had, would he have reasonably expected his question to elicit incriminating information? And if so, then he has to give Miranda warnings before he asks that question. And the almost every case that is cited by the state or the defense fits neatly within that rule. If it's a question that a reasonable officer could not have anticipated an incriminating response to, then it's okay. It's a booking question. But if the officer should have anticipated, reasonably anticipated, an incriminating response, he's got to give Miranda warnings. And if he doesn't, it doesn't come in, regardless of the good faith of the officer.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Thank you, Mr. Curl. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is submitted, and you are excused. We will recess until 10:30 when we'll take up our 10:30 case.